Hello. This is Michael Klein. I'm here with Carrie Klein in the staff quarters of the lower library, the afternoon of June 4th. And would you say your name and introduce? I'll hold it.
Okay. Mario Favorito.
Say my name is?
My name is Mario Favorito.
Okay. And we never ask people their ages, but maybe you tell us your date of birth.
1638.
Okay. And tell us a little about your people and where you were raised.
I was born in Brooklyn, New York. My mother was born in Brooklyn in 1909. Her father, my grandfather, arrived sometime in 1898 or thereabouts in Brooklyn. I spent my childhood and all the my years during which I was educated in Brooklyn. We did go across to Manhattan periodically, but that was the city. I have to say I was pretty parochial, because I didn't realize that there was a world outside of Brooklyn until I graduated from law school and decided to leave New York.
You didn't realize?
There was, you know, everything that one needed was in Brooklyn. I did, as a child, when you could travel all around the city for 5 cents, travel to museums in Manhattan. I learned how to ride English Saddle in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. I did travel afar to Staten Island to ride horses every once in a while, or into Central Park. But essentially, I'd say Brooklyn-centric. When I graduated from law school, I decided to leave the city and go to Washington, D.C.
Well, wait a minute. Before you leave Brooklyn, if I was someone lowered in a helicopter in the middle of the night on the streets of Brooklyn in the late 1930s, how would I have known I was there?
It had no tall buildings except the Williamsburg Savings Bank. There were lots of trees and neighborhoods. It was quite different from the metropolis in Manhattan.
Neighborhoods?
There were neighborhoods. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. There were German-oriented neighborhoods, Irish, Jewish, various places around.
And the Italian neighborhood was called?
Well, it was called South Brooklyn, but today it has very fancy names. It has names like Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill, and it was essentially in an area that was close to the part of Brooklyn that overlooks Manhattan. Today it's very, very fashionable. When I was growing up, it was also fashionable, but at a lower level. It was an area of brownstones. The brownstones were built in the late 1800s and were built by people with means, who had come across from Manhattan on the Brooklyn Bridge, but there were the Pierponts, people like one of my neighbors. Well, he wasn't a neighbor at the time, but one of the houses was built by a person who was named Kinsella, who was an editor of the and a publisher of the Brooklyn Eagle, which was a wonderful newspaper, which went out of business in, I think, in the 70s.
Progressive sort of paper?
I guess you would say progressive. I would say progressive. When I was reading it, I was mostly interested in, you know, whatever local issues might arise, but also the baseball. I really didn't have a focus so much on the editorial page at the time, but it was a great newspaper. But the area that I grew up in It was made up of lots of wonderful brownstones. They were mostly family-owned, hadn't been carved up into, you know, condos and whatever. Today, they're very, very expensive, and people are carving them up into very expensive condos. My brother just sold his house there because he wanted to sort of downsize and move closer to his family. So we don't. I have a nephew who still lives in that neighborhood, but not too many more people live there. But it's kind of odd, or interesting, I should say, that when both of my children were working in Manhattan, they ended up living in the same neighborhood where I grew up, because it was because that's where they, you know, their grandmother and grandfather were when they were little kids. We'd visit, and so they gravitated back there. And so it was kind of interesting that they basically went back to the old neighborhood. And my daughter, my younger daughter Laura, mentioned to me that after my mother and father had passed away, and she had went down to register to vote, that the registrar said, "Oh, you're one of the favoritos. You're okay. It's okay. You can vote." She chuckled, and I chuckled too. So it was a very nice neighborhood when I was growing up there, and it's still a very nice neighborhood.
Were there neighborhood, gangs would be too strong a word, but
we had a few toughs, but there weren't really street gangs where we were. There were basically some wise kids, and I held my ground. I remember a couple of times where close by there was a police station that had a police athletic league group where children could play basketball or whatever. And I remember there was a pool table that we'd all gravitate to play at, and I was dutifully in line waiting to play my turn. And I remember this fellow sort of bullied himself in front of me, and I was very polite, saying, "When I was here first, you have to get in line." He started to push me, so I turned around and I whacked him in the nose. So he got back there, and I stayed in line. But there was that kind of stuff. There wasn't anything that hear about today or in other neighborhoods. I'll say the usual stuff. We had a couple of bullies. That was about it. I have to say there were a couple of instances where I used to walk. That's one thing you did in the city. We walked everywhere. I mean, I walked to grammar school, I walked to high school, I walked to college, I walked to law school. It was just within walking distance of all of my house. Some of the walks were maybe a mile and a half, maybe two, but it wasn't a big problem. I'd walk all the way up to Prospect Park. I'd walk all over the place. And I enjoyed it. Walked over the Brooklyn Bridge. It was very enjoyable. Every once in a while, when you're walking through a certain neighborhood, you could get harassed a little bit, but it wasn't nothing to worry about.
So the law school was?
St. John's University School of Law. At the time, the law school was in downtown Brooklyn. I guess the year I graduated, they moved out to a campus out in Queens, a Hillcrest campus, so everything is out now in Queens County. But when I was growing up, everything was within walking distance of my house. And my mother was a seamstress. My father worked for the telephone company. We didn't have a lot of means. But as Karina mentioned with her family, my parents said, "You will get an education." It was an expectation, and that's what you did. My brother became a lawyer as well. People in my apartment house, we lived in an apartment house. We had several physicians that grew up in the apartment house. I mean, people just, you know, you go to school. We had a couple of bad apples too, but, you know, the expectation was there, you will get an education. But education was, in a sense, generic. You know, college was generic. It wasn't Harvard or Yale. It was, you're going to go to college. And that's what we did. Good people with good expectations and all hardworking. So not unusual. It's a common story. I do recall, I always had a part-time job, and it was always an expectation that we would also earn a little money, you know, to take care of our needs, so I always did that. I worked for Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, I worked for White Weld, which was a securities firm in Lower Manhattan. I actually learned how to fill out tax returns for people, because my father had a friend who was a person who had a travel agency and was an accountant, and he needed help. So I learned how to make out people's tax returns, made a few dollars doing that as well. I was sort of a whatever needed to be done. I was a good learner. I didn't think I was doing anything special. It was just what you did. Went ahead, and I always, had activities, whether it was working or playing stickball or any of the games in the neighborhood or whatever. We just, had lots of friends. Some of them we went horseback riding. Others we went to the beach. It was quite a network. Mm-hmm. I have to say they were pretty much all male. it was segregated in a lot of ways.
An Italian immigrant neighborhood?
Yes. If I remember the history, the neighborhood... The South Brooklyn neighborhood, at one point, was the largest Italian immigrant community in the United States. It was huge. I'm not sure what it is today, but... And families looked out for one another. I mean, there was always someone at the window watching where you went, when you came home, what you did. It was kind of like one big extended family, the local church, or there's lots of churches.
Parochial school.
Yeah, I did go to parochial school. In fact, I have to say, all my education was Catholic based. I mean, it was the grammar school, the high school, St. Francis College, St. John's University. Although it was kind of interesting, it was also very, very open. I mean, when you were a small kid at grammar school, everybody had a catechism class. But beyond that, it was just what I would describe as a professional education. I mean, we went through all the subjects, and I don't recall being limited in any way. But...
So it included religious education?
Oh, it did. Certainly in grammar school it did. In high school, I think once a month you were required to go to mass, go to church. In college, I don't think there was that much pressure, and certainly not in law school. The law school that I went into, which was St. John's University School of Law, originally started out as a law school that was an independent law school. And my memory of the history is that in the late 1920, somewhere in there, there were a group of lawyers who lamented the fact that that law schools of the day were not admitting people who were women, Jewish, Italian, whatever, and they really wanted to open that up. So they started St. John's University School of, well, St. John's Law School at the time, for the purpose of providing for a legal education to those people from families who were basically, in their view, excluded from legal education. And so they established the law school and then sought affiliation with St. John's University, which was a Catholic university, and still is, and with the idea that they'd run it affiliated with the law school, but basically be independent within that structure. And that went on for, 30 years, maybe 20 years, and then it was finally integrated into the university. But it's fairly independent in any event. But it was an interesting start to the law school, and we had philosophy. There was a philosophy class, but that's what I remember.
Extracurricular activities there, sports, things like that.
Well, my extracurricular activity was the law review. I was when I got admitted to the law school. It was kind of interesting. I got admitted on by the skin of my teeth. I wasn't that great on some of these tests. But lo and behold, the first semester, I ended up being sixth in the class and got an offer to join the law review in a scholarship. So we marched on from there. Hmm. So,
In high school, you ran track?
Oh, well, high school? Yeah. I got my varsity track letter in my sophomore year. I was editor of the school. I was sports editor of the high school newspaper, and it's where I decided, for no particular reason, to become a lawyer, because I thought I was going to become either an architect or an electrical engineer, and then I ran into trigonometry. And I got the first C in my life. And it was sort of a harbinger that maybe your engineering wasn't going to be cut out for you. This was in high school. So I did the sports and whatever. And then we had public speaking and whatever. Make a long story short, I won a couple of oratorical contests. Someone said, yeah, you ought to be a lawyer. Guess what? Became a lawyer.
Don't forget about Jackie Robinson.
Jackie Robinson, yes. My uncle was a butcher, and he was a New York Giants fan. But butchers in those days had access to tickets to baseball games and other things. And even though my uncle was a fan of the New York Giants, whose home base was up on Manhattan on Coogan's Bluff, one day he called my mother and he said, I want to take Mario to a baseball game. It's at night, but don't worry, I'll take care of him. And it's important. So my mother said, sure, you can take him. So we went. Well, it was 1947, and Jackie Robinson was playing first base. It was his first season. And it was the spring, and they were playing the Pirates. And I was one of the few kids at 9 years old to see Jackie Robinson and his whole team. But I remember him saying, it's important, this is important. So we went. But Brooklyn was a wonderful place, and probably still is.
Would you have known you were in an Italian neighborhood if you'd been dropped in there?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were Italian pastry shops.
Oh,
I mean,
there's
Italian restaurants. Yes, the answer is yes. You would have known that. But that was because there were many different neighborhoods. You know, you'd know you go from one neighborhood to another, and it was nothing. When you're growing up, it didn't seem remarkable at all. But if you knew, if you were coming from Manhattan, that this was an Italian neighborhood, for example. There were religious feasts, especially in the fall. Streets would get blocked off for block parties. There would be stages that would be up on stilts above the sidewalks where bands would be playing, singers would be singing. It was just one big festa. We had several of those a year. Kids have fun. We had fun. People ate sausages and whatever. It was just, and the music went on till midnight and everything sort of stopped. And it was usually a three-day affair. And these were run by the religious societies of the various churches. But it was part of growing up in that neighborhood. And, of course, being part of the community, it didn't seem odd to me at all. It was just, you know, what you did. Everybody, it was extended family. Everybody was friendly, and people went in and out of one's houses with not a care. It was just everybody was welcomed. When I was a kid, one of my neighbors had the first TV sets. Guess where all the kids went? We were sitting there watching, I forget what it was, Howdy Doody or whatever. But it was...
Followed by Dragnet.
Dragnet, right. I enjoyed watching early television, mostly the news programs, the 52 convention when Eisenhower was it Eisenhower or Stevenson? I forget, but I remember, you know, watching those conventions that first came on. It was very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Didn't watch a whole lot of other stuff, but I like news.
So what was your path then to Concord?
Well, it was kind of easy in a sense. When I met Karina in Washington, we decided that we wanted to move back. She wanted to move back to New England. She didn't particularly think it was a good idea to move to New York City. And so I said, well, New England sounds okay.
Where were you working?
Yeah. So I ended up in the Office of Navy General Counsel in Washington. Then I went from there to United Aircraft Corporation in Hartford. And then decided to look around for another position, and Karina helped me find an ad that brought me to a job as counsel for a W.R. Grayson company, which was headquartered in Cambridge. So we moved, and we needed to find a place to stay, to call home, and I made, I guess, an executive decision. I decided, from what I had heard, I was never going to drive on Route 128. And since I was in Cambridge, I was going to go out Route 2, and we were going to live either in Arlington, Lexington, Lincoln, Concord, or maybe Acton. But that was it. And I had some friends at the office who lived in Concord. We came out. We looked for places in the snow. It was February. I mean, it was just unbelievable. We found the house in Concord, and also I understood that there was a great, the schools were superb. So location, superb schools, here we are. Very simple.
We both skipped the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, I was in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis in Washington, D.C. at the time. This was before then, in October. My memory as a Navy lawyer in the Office of Naval General Counsel was that I was, because of my civilian rank, I was a civilian lawyer, I was given a military rank of lieutenant commander just in case, and I would be made an instant lieutenant commander, which was kind of odd because at the time I don't think I was more than 26. I mean, it was just, you know, whatever, but the plan was that if things were really bad, that I would be airlifted out to Southern Virginia and help the troops requisition whatever they needed to requisition, and they needed a lawyer, and so that was going to be my duty station. And I remember having a briefing during the Cuban Missile Crisis by the officer in charge. And how he very well explained to us that in case of nuclear attack, that what would happen is that there were a group of people, you know, like the higher-ups, would be airlifted out, whatever, and that we would be in the second wave of exodus from Washington, D.C. And I remember one of my lawyer friends saying to this officer, and pray tell, how many of us do you think will still be here when we're ready for the second exodus? Well, it never happened, but it was an interesting time, and Karina was living in an apartment house with children and families from the Russian embassy, and she was convinced there was going to be no attack because the women were still washing clothes in the laundromat in the basement, and the children were still going to school. So given that, she figured out there would never be an attack because otherwise the kids wouldn't be here.
I was in the elevator with the Russian diplomats that morning after the president's speech, and I didn't realize that they were Russian, and then the car from the embassy came to pick them up. They all shook hands, and then after they got into the car, all these little children with red bows on their arms came out, and they got into another car, and as I went down Connecticut Avenue, I saw them all going into the Russian embassy. This was the morning after President Kennedy's speech about the blockade. And so everyone at the office was very frightened. One man left. He said he was taking his children and going to Maine. And I kept saying, but the children are still there. I can't believe that Khrushchev would bomb Washington if all the children are still there, going to school at the embassy. That was my big, the whole country was frightened, and I'm still saying, but the children are still there. So I guess I was the calmest person around because I was convinced that everything was going to be all right. Maybe it was very naive of me, but...
It may have been, but you have good instincts.
Yes, for sure. At any rate, so we kind of lived through that. It was a very, very good time. Obviously, I was there when President Kennedy was shot, and I was in the Maine Navy building, which was where my office was. After the news came in the Maine Navy building, you could hear a pin drop. It was total silence. And I remember walking the halls, and hardly anybody spoke. It was just a somber moment. So, where am I?
We're trying to get you up here to Concord. and you've looked around, you decided the corridor you want to live in.
Right.
And
it's snowy.
It's snowy. Well, here I am. And again, the reason we came here was because of the reputation of the town, the education, and its proximity to my job. But it was kind of interesting. When we got here, having grown up in a city, I found that the town meeting form of government, the volunteerism, was all very interesting. I said, gee, this is unbelievable. And we have had a system, and we still have a system, where if you're interested in serving on town government, you can make out a green card with your name and what you'd like to do and put the green card in. And so I did, because I couldn't believe as a kid from Brooklyn that you actually could have, there actually was a way in which you could actually participate in your local government to make things happen. So I found that was really unique. So I put my green card in. And
didn't John ask you about to join something?
Oh, that was later on. But at any rate, we're here in 72 or 73, I got a call from the town manager, Paul Flynn. And he said, looking at your green card, and it says here you have some background in transportation. I said, yeah, I do. Because when I was at United Aircraft, I was one of my legal projects was to be involved in the program to develop high-speed rail along the corridor from Boston to Washington, and They were doing that in the 60s, what they're still trying to do today. But anyhow, that's another story. So he said, well, we have this new committee that we're going to have to populate. It's called the Bus Transportation Committee. Would you be interested? I said, sure. So I went down and I talked with Paul. I talked with Phoebe Ham, who was the chair of the committee, and a few other people. And so my job was to establish the Bus Transportation Committee. So I did some research. And
they asked you to chair it?
No, I think Phoebe Ham chaired it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to chair things. I like to. I'm a doer, sort of. Whatever. So Phoebe chaired it, and what I found out was, okay, the town, the school department has the buses, the town has a need, so we decided that we would use the buses during the time when they weren't busing kids, which would be like between 10 a.m. and 2. So I drafted a contract between the town and the school committee to allow the town to use the buses, because you needed to have a contractual document. I hauled myself down to the Massachusetts Transportation Authority to learn a little bit about what you had to do to run a bus service, and they immediately told me that if it was a service where you charge money, then the bus drivers had to be of a certain salary range. There were all these rules and regulations, and it just looked like it would take forever to get it done. So I went back and I said, my recommendation is that we do it as a free bus service. That way we just avoid all these regulations. And the town said, that's fine. So the town had a budget authorized by town meeting, which paid for the use of the buses and the drivers. We established routes. It was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to do what Karina had indicated, we were off to the races. It worked very, very well, and went on for quite a number of years. And then we had little issues. I think one of the years there was a fuel crisis. I don't know if it was 73 or 74. We found a way to the fuel. Town had fuel, so we used the town's fuel and reimbursed the town for the fuel. So once the program and the project got going, and it was, I said, okay, there's nothing more that I can do. Other people can run it now that it's established. So I said goodbye, and Phoebe said, how about Karina filling in where you? So Karina became one of my successors in the Bus Transportation Committee. And then when the bicentennial of 1975 came in, and we were planning for that, because I had been on the Bus Transportation Committee and knew something about transportation, I was asked to join the Transportation Subcommittee of the Bicentennial Committee. Yeah, it's a mouthful. And the purpose there was to organize routes for people to come into town, to get out of town, make sure we knew where all of the marchers from Sudbury in clothes, their uniforms could come in, where we'd park the cars, because there was a presidential visit that was going to happen. We had also planned for where the presidential motorcade was going to come, where they were going to park, where the buses were going to park. The most direct route to the operating room at Emerson Hospital, God forbid something happened, so we had to deal with that. I remember we had a visitation from the representative of the Secret Service, which they were informed that all those people dressed up in all those colonial clothes actually had guns, and they were going to shoot them off. And they said, they are. But we got through that. So it took a couple of years of planning, and it was a lot of fun. I met a lot of interesting people, and you know, did that job, and it was
you
done.
Did other things.
Huh?
You did more important things.
No, well, subsequent to that, someone thought that maybe I might be useful on the planning board, so I was asked to become a member of the planning board, and I said sure. So that was 6 years on planning. And subsequent to that, someone said, well, you know all about zoning. How about being a member of the Board of Zoning Appeals? And I said, sure, I'll do that. That's one of my troubles. I don't know how to say no. But I love the town. It's a wonderful town. I mean, you go around the country and you compare it to what we have here, and it's just what I want to do is to help out anywhere I can. It's just a great community, lots of good, talented people. It's a, in a lot of ways, it's a meritocracy in its finest form. It doesn't make any difference where you've come from, if you come from Brooklyn or whatever. If you want to help and you've got some talent, you got a job. And it's all volunteer. Nobody gets paid. And the town could not run without volunteers. And I've been asked to do some other things. I was on an ad hoc committee to select the town manager, an ad hoc committee to select the town council. And then I was appointed in 1995. Someone asked me if they took me to breakfast. And I should have known that was a bad sign. They asked me if I should be a trustee. Would I like to be a trustee? And the library, the Concord Free Public Library Corporation. And I said yes. And the library, the way things work in Concord, is that the corporation, which is a nonprofit corporation established by act of the legislature in 1873, actually owns the library. The buildings, whatever. The town, and then there's a partnership with the town. The town funds all of the staff and pays for the utilities. So it's really a classic partnership between a private group and the town. And we, people love the library in this town, and they contribute untold amount of funds to the library and contributions, bequests, and whatever. And we're able, with the endowment, to pay for all of the costs involved in renovating these structures, making sure that they stay in good repair, the plantings, the groundskeeping, and all of that. And I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation some time ago, and if you say the library is the joint partnership between the town and the independent library corporation, there's a total expense involved in providing a library to the Concord community. And the library corporation, through the munificence of its citizens, actually provides 40% of the support of the library. So, but we couldn't do it without people who love the library. I mean, it just the story that I tell about myself is that when I was in high school, my high school teacher required that we read a good bit of Emerson's work, and also of Thoreau's work. He was really a super guy. I have to say this is sacrilegious, but I hated Emerson. Well, my reward was to become a trustee of the Concord Free Public Library, who has to manage all of Emerson's works.
You see the bed you have to lie.
That's right. That's right. So I'm learning to like Emerson. So my story is not complicated at all. I mean, I just I like the idea of volunteering. It's a great town. It's wonderful to be able to contribute in whatever way you can, and I keep doing it.
Well, your spirit of volunteerism is exceeded only by your humility about your own accomplishments. I can tell that off the bat.
I just
and I know how much this I've already heard how much this town appreciates both of you and the amazing contributions that you made. You certainly got the gist of the place quickly and jumped right into it.
No, it was very. You mean I actually can affect what goes on here?
Thank you both very, very much.
It's our pleasure.
Well, thank you for taking the time.